Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Robert Fieseler, author of Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. We'll also hear from Nick White about his wonderful new short story collection, Sweet and Low. Robert Fieseler is a journalist, a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism who works in Boston. Today we're talking about his first book, Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. Robert Fieseler, welcome to The Reading Life.
Happy to be here, Susan.
Now, the Upstairs Lounge Fire, for listeners who may not know, was a terrible tragedy. It was the arson of a French Quarter gay bar in 1973 that claimed the lives of 32 people. So, Bobby, what was it that led you to go back to this event and re-examine it in such detail?
It was almost like this event found me. So I was expressing to two Columbia Journalism School professors while I was a student there that I was interested in writing a book that took a look at the early nascent phase of the gay rights movement when it was called Gay Liberation. Mm-hmm. And one of the professors was named Nicholas Lemon, who had grown up in New Orleans and had spent some time there as a baby reporter for a publication that was then an alt-weekly in the French Quarter called the Vieux Carré Courier. And he said, had you ever heard about this event called like the Upstairs Lounge Fire? And I said, I had not. And he said he had done some reporting in the summer of 1973 around that event, but he'd never really touched on or reported that event specifically. He recalled how his mentor, Bill Rushton, who was then a very famous French Quarter character, activist, played all sorts of roles, wore many hats, similar to in the great lineage of French Quarter characters. And he recalled how his mentor, Bill Rushton, had reported on the Upstairs Lounge Fire for an extended period of time. And then I tried to ask Professor Lemon any more questions he could recall, and he said he couldn't. He said it was strange. There was almost a very hazy understanding of it. And it was the first time when I was interacting with him that he expressed this inability to articulate what was going on. Professor Lemon's the kind of guy that oftentimes can remember year to year what he ate for dinner on a certain night. There was something interesting culturally going on that had caused a kind of mass forgetfulness, if you will, or something that had overarchingly resulted in this event not becoming top of mind, even for him, who was an individual who took a very early and very interesting look at the gay rights phenomenon nationally and in New Orleans. So, of course, I had to find out more.
You take a lot of pains to create the lives of those you knew were at the fire, and readers come to know them as real characters, real people, and we come to care about them and their lives. And you spent a lot of time talking with survivors, researching the lives of those who were lost in the fire. Talk about that process of getting people to talk about this event.
Sure. I mean, that was a tremendous challenge, but also a very important challenge. I wanted each of these men's and women's lives to feel consequential to the reader. From a nonfiction perspective and from a journalistic perspective, I saw in the story of the Upstairs Lounge the need, at least in this narrative, to rebuild and reconstruct the historic closet, really that had erased a lot of these men's lives and a lot of these men's stories. Even prior to the fire, a lot of these men lived in a kind of invisible state, in a kind of uniquely idiosyncratic closeted life. So I wanted to give, in some sense, voice to the voiceless, which I guess is the purpose of what a lot of journalists seek to do. And I wanted to bring to the forefront what their day-to-day experiences were like. What were the kind of lives that they were forced to lead in a society where, because of an innate characteristic, they had become criminal? Something that they couldn't help, right, had kind of shunted them into a criminalized subgroup. And how did they live? What were their lives like? The answer was they lived very carefully, but they also lived very fascinatingly rich lives. And I wanted to highlight these were lives that were full of joy, you know, oftentimes, surprisingly. And I wanted to bring to the surface what the day-to-day existence of a closeted gay man would have been like at that period of time in 1973, just so a reader could see the incredible triumphs and tragedies and the incredible of these individuals and the incredible manner in which a gay man living an out lifestyle, even in a semi-out lifestyle, had overcome so much just to get to the upstairs lounge and be present at a beer bust at the busiest, most bustling night of the week of a popular bar on the night of June 24th, 1973. So it was important to me that their lives felt consequential in the narrative because they were consequential per se.
Well, I think of that young soldier who drove every weekend to come to the upstairs lounge from Texas because it was that important to him to have this life.
Yes. New Orleans had played a very important part in his coming out process. He'd made one of his best friends, Stuart Butler, who's still kicking around New Orleans, after the upstairs lounge in the wake of it became quite a locally famous and actually regionally famous gay activist. For Stephen, New Orleans had a very important role in his private persona. The distance between his closeted existence in San Antonio, it was actually Randolph, Texas, where he served at Randolph Air Force Base. The eight-hour drive between that military base and New Orleans put some miles in distance and allowed him to live his two lives. And New Orleans has had a long and storied tradition of serving the needs of closeted gay servicemen in that it was a place where they could find community and be among friends without a vast array of professional and personal consequence.
And how hard was it for you to get the survivors to talk to you about this?
It depends. Some were overarchingly eager to tell their stories because it was part of their healing process. There's been several very, very worthy tellings of this event thus far. And some of the survivors have told their story again and again now to the point where I feel it is part of the way they heal.
Uh-huh.
It's important for them to tell and retell the story as many times as possible because they want other people to know what happened, what it was like, what their experience was. There are others who, because of the nature of the trauma and because of the state of closeted society in 1973, where psychological and psychiatric counseling was not made available, and even if it was made available, there was a widespread fear and bias in that in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association, DSM, still listed homosexuality as a sexual deviancy disorder. So there was a fear to seek out that help. And because of that, a lot of the survivors have, over the years and decades, managed in their own ways. In some ways, they have not.
Mm-hmm.
So in those cases, you're facing individuals with, justifiably so, a psyche that is wounded in this specific regard, and an individual who does not want to delve into the darkness of what they experienced in that span of time. And for those individuals, it was a very careful and sensitive dance to the point where I understood if they didn't wish to speak. And there were some individuals for whom it's so painful that they still, 4.5 decades later, cannot delve into what happened in those minutes. And for others, the prolonged dance, sometimes for up to 3 years at a span of time, enabled a kind of trusting relationship to be developed. And from there, we were able to eventually sit down and have that conversation where they were able to relate their experiences in a way that felt healing to them.
One of the things that is, I think, most heartbreaking about your story is the lack of religious solace for these people, the difficulty they had in finding a place even to worship and come together. And so many of the victims were bound together by their participation in the same church.
Correct. Yes. Many of the victims, about a third of the upstairs lounge victims, were members of a gay-affirming Christian denomination called the Metropolitan Community Church, which had been founded in Los Angeles in 1968 by a leader named Troy Perry, who by 1973 was one of the most visible faces for homosexuality in the country. And the members of the MCC of New Orleans had spent about 2 years together building up a kind of Christian fellowship. That Sunday, June 24th, 1973, a group of those men had held a religious service, and following that service, they decided to celebrate some additional fellowship and spend some more time together by spending the evening at the upstairs lounge. And unfortunately, of that congregation of 30 men, about 10 perished, including the deacon and the pastor of that specific church. So in essence, that congregation was gutted by the fire. Following the events of that night, the next morning, Troy Perry, the founding pastor to the Metropolitan Community Church, who was then in Los Angeles helping his own congregation celebrate Pride Weekend — that weekend was National Pride Weekend — heard about the upstairs lounge and immediately sprung into action, alerted his national network, and then flew to New Orleans to try to help his grieving congregation, which had been destroyed, and to also help the community become aware of the fire that occurred just in town. And Troy Perry met with, and as my book delves into, I should say a very mixed reaction. He did meet with some allies who were willing to help him take up the banner to, again, help the public become cognizant of this terrible disaster that had occurred on the border of the French Quarter. But also, he was an outsider who had a method that was considered very radical for the time period, which was he was a proponent of sexual openness and gay liberation, and he was a homosexual Christian, which was considered radical and really unthinkable for the time period among the major denominations who would not accept such an identity. And therefore, Troy Perry was oftentimes labeled in his press conferences that he held in New Orleans and in the events that he helped stage over the course of the week that followed the upstairs lounge fire. He was often called a fairy carpetbagger.
Writing this book must have taken such a personal toll for you. But how did it advance your writing life? What did it do for you as a writer to make sense of this story and place it in context?
Yeah, this book allowed me to gain access to a gay world that no longer exists. It allowed me to meet men and women who participated in this underground society at a time when homosexuality held great personal risk, when it really meant something to be who you were at that span of time, and especially to be open about it. And so I would say gaining access to that now destroyed gay world that was in essence destroyed by not just the upstairs lounge fire, but by the AIDS crisis and by just the march of time, allowed me a window into what gay liberation was like when it was nascent, when it was just getting started, and when people were just, in essence, fighting for the right to exist against the public that did not want to hear it.
And here we are, 45 years later, and yeah. I understand that congratulations are in order because you were recently married.
Oh my gosh, yes. Absolutely.
Which is something magical.
Yes, it was. Absolutely, it was. It was incredibly emotional. And especially against the context of the upstairs lounge, it was, it was hard for me to place those two events together because you're correct. The times have changed so dramatically. We no longer live with the closet as a governing institution, and the march of gay liberation from the 1970s, which eventually became the gay and lesbian movement, you know, in the late 1970s, early 80s, which became the LGB movement, or the lesbian, gay, bisexual movement, and then eventually the LGBT movement, eventually the LGBTQ movement. The progression of it is almost unfathomable in terms of the level of social change and ideological change that's occurred for the average person in that span of time.
This book is such an important document in the chronicle of that struggle. We've been talking with Robert Fiesler about Tinderbox, the untold story of the upstairs lounge fire and the rise of gay liberation. You can meet him coming up June 27th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection when he discusses the book at the celebration of the LGBT archives, and again Friday, June 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bobby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take your mind back, I don't know when, sometime when it always seemed to be just us and them. Girls that wore pink, boys that wore blue, boys that always grew up better men than me and you.
Nick White made a splash with his first novel, How to Survive a Summer, and he's doing it again with his new story collection, Sweet and Low, perfect for summer reading. Nick's originally from Mississippi, and he now teaches creative writing at The Ohio State University. Nick White, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, how are you, Susan?
I'm great, Nick. I love these stories so much. I always think when I read this book, I'll underline it or I'll mark something, but instead I just settle back and read because it's so much fun. I mean,
Thank you. I think every writer probably wants to hear that.
You're
entertained.
Well, you grew up in Possum Neck, Mississippi. And coming from a place like that, did you think you'd ever be able to escape becoming a writer?
That's a very good question. When people have phrased that question to me, it's always like, how did you ever become a writer being from Possum Neck, Mississippi? You know? And my thought is exactly what your question implies. How could I grow up in Possum Neck, Mississippi and not become a writer?
Exactly. So what was it like? Tell us about it.
Well, it was very insular, very small. I didn't originally live in Possum Neck when I was growing up. I didn't move there until I was in the fourth grade. Before that, we lived in a small town about 20 miles away called Kosciuszko, mm-hmm. named for the Polish revolutionary Thaddeus Kosciuszko.
Right.
And that's where my parents still work, and they just drive in from the country. And so we moved to Possum Neck because my grandfather and grandmother lived there, and so did several of my aunts and uncles on my mom's side. And we moved closer there to take care of my grandparents because they were getting older.
So if you grow up in a place like that, I'm curious, who showed you it was possible to be a writer? Who was your first model for becoming a writer?
Well, I think it was the books I read.
Mm-hmm.
I always read when I was a child. I always kept a journal. I was fascinated with the idea of keeping a journal and documenting one's life and having like a particular book set aside where you just wrote the events of your life down at the end of the day.
Uh-huh.
I found that to be just fascinating. And I didn't, this sounds very cheesy, but I didn't know to do that until I saw that old television show, The Walton.
Uh-huh.
You remember that?
Yes,
with John
of course.
my parents loved that show. I think that's like where I got the idea to like keep a journal. And so I would just keep a journal. I would read a lot. I was very involved in Kosciuszko. My parents would drive me to the summer library program. You know, I was just fascinated with books, with not just the stories themselves, but just like the physical objects.
Holding
them in my hands. And I remember when I was reading, I think it was her One Writer's Beginning, I think, Eudora Welty's memoir,
uh-huh.
a very short memoir. I think she says it somewhere in there, but I could be wrong, where she was disappointed when she realized that books were written by human authors. She thought they just sort of on the ground. And I had that feeling too. I was like, surely these books, like they just seemed like such magic to me.
And now here you are.
Yeah,
with one of your very own. Now, am I right that you wrote most of these short stories before you wrote your novel?
I think I started before and then alongside.
Ah, gotcha.
I'm working on two projects right now at the same time. I think it's because I would exhaust myself with the novel with as much as I could do.
Mm-hmm.
But I would need maybe a week or 2 weeks, and I would turn to something else to feel productive. And so I would work on a story. The second part of the collection is link stories of the character Forney Culpepper. And so sometimes I would want to check in on Forney and see how he was doing and see what, like, you know, what part of his life I wanted to write about. I wouldn't finish that story in 2 weeks, but I would start working on it. Usually the timetable for when I finish a story varies from project to project. I never know. I say this to my students all the time. No story or nothing that I've ever written has ever taught me how to write the next thing. It's always only taught me how to write that particular thing.
Words of wisdom.
Every time I start something new, it always feels like I'm starting from scratch. There's always that blank page to contend with.
Right. Now, two of these stories are so remarkable. I love The Lovers. with its podcasting protagonist, Rosemary. And I loved These Heavenly Bodies, about a young man and his relationship with a pair of conjoined twins. Now, these stories seem straight out of Flannery O'Connor channeled via Nick White into something completely new. And those two stories I thought were remarkable.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved writing The Lovers. I just had such a great experience writing that story because of many reasons, but I love Rosemary as a character. I hope one day I get to come back to her. I find her very interesting. I also love the idea of these two characters living in Jackson, Mississippi, and sort of swirling around each other and intersecting with each other and not really understanding why, well, from Rosemary's perspective, but really sort of her whole relationship to the other character in that book is really just like pure sort of instinct, right?
She's
sort of like circling around him and not really sure why. It's that thing when you meet someone and you feel like you should know them, but you don't know why you feel like you should know them. I wanted to depict a Southern character that knew what technology was.
Yes.
had a podcast and was a smart, intelligent person, but still very much blind in certain aspects of her life. The same with the male character in that book. One of the things I had fun writing about for the very first time was being diabetic. You know, I'm diabetic myself.
Ah.
I'm a type 1. I was diagnosed late in life, just like the character in the story. And I wanted to write about that too. And I had great fun doing that one. With the story of These Heavenly Bodies, the thing that started that story for me was the first sentence. It's a very long sentence, and I just sort of started with that first sentence, and it just kept unwinding, and I decided to just follow it.
Can you read it for us?
Okay.
Okay.
So this is the first sentence in These Heavenly Bodies. That was the summer. Benjamin was so thin, he barely cast a shadow. The summer he pedaled his clunky one-speed everywhere, around the dusty town square, across Turtle Bridge, down to Merrill Creek. The same slow-moving, bone-weary summer after his mother died and his father stopped preaching and his Aunt Beatrice from Biloxi stayed on after the funeral until things settled down, she said, which meant he knew, until his father pulled himself out of his grief. That summer, which was so different from any other in his life so far, was also the summer of the Cade twins.
Now that is a sentence. So I'm curious how you feel about all this. The stage is kind of set for your grand success. You know, people are already comparing you to Tennessee Williams. How does that make you feel?
It feels great, but it also makes me always like look behind me. I have a huge imposter syndrome. I always will have. I mean, I'm a first-generation college student, and the whole time I was in college, when I was getting my undergraduate degree, even when I was working on my master, too, like I kept like thinking I was a big fraud, and I was putting on a charade, and as soon as they figured out, you know, I would say something or do something, they would all realize that I didn't belong.
Oh, no. Oh, no. You belong. Trust me.
Thank you. I'm coming to that. But I do think it's something that a lot of first-generation college students struggle with, this idea of like belonging in a place, because the realms of academia and the world of creative writing can sometimes feel very alien to where I was from, I'm from, you know. But it's great. It's so wonderful. It's already beyond anything I could have imagined. The greatest part of it, I think, is the emails that I get from queer folk from the South who email me and want to talk about the book.
That's fantastic.
It's been the novel primarily, mm-hmm. Because the short story collection hasn't come out. Just like talking to them when I go down to Mississippi to read, having them come to the readings and feeling them there, and this moment of recognition where I see them and they see me. It happened when I went to Mississippi State recently to give a reading in Starkville. I went there, and it was on a Thursday right before Starkville was going to host its very first gay pride parade. And at first, the Board of Aldermen there in the city turned down the students who wanted to petition to have a, I think you had to have a permit for the parade. And I think the ACLU got involved, and eventually they did a revote and they were able to have it. When I came there to the reading, some of the students who were leading the charge against making sure that they got to have this parade in Starkville, they were there at the reading, and they had a gift bag for me with all this Starkville Pride memorabilia. I'm still wearing the bracelet. Meanwhile, when I went to school there, I never would have imagined something like this could be there. So after the reading, they invited, because I gave the reading in the student union, they invited me downstairs to a room that they had reserved to watch the latest episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. And so I followed them down there, and I don't mean to get sentimental, but it always chokes me up a little bit when I think about it, because I walked in this room and there's all these queer kids laughing and talking back to the television screen and just having a wonderful time and taking up space. And it was just so beautiful, Susan. I just, this sort of like hard won space that they were taking up, and they were just having a wonderful time. They had gotten a business to make who does gourmet popcorn to get them rainbow colored popcorn for the night. And it was just wonderful. And for the first time in a long time, I felt at home while being home.
Oh, God. Oh, Nick, what a story. Well, I love this book, and I think everybody else will, too. We've been talking with Nick White, whose wonderful new short story collection is called Sweet and Low. You can meet him Wednesday, June 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop when he appears with novelist Matthew Griffith, author of Hyde, along with agent Catherine Fawcett. Nick, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, too. Thank you, too. It's been wonderful, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Hannah Pittard discusses and signs her new novel, Visible Empire, Tuesday, June 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Omer Bartov discusses Anatomy of a Genocide, The Life and Death of a Town Called Bocage, Wednesday, June 27th at the National World War II Museum's Louisiana Memorial Pavilion. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Robert Fieseler discusses and signs Tinderbox, the untold story of the upstairs lounge fire and the rise of gay liberation. That's Wednesday, June 27th at 6 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, celebrating the LGBT archives. He also appears Friday, June 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. Novelist Matthew Griffin, author of Hyde, and Nick White, author of Sweet and Low, discuss their books with agent Catherine Fawcett, Wednesday, June 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Melissa Dackett discusses and signs the paperback edition of Spiritualism in 19th Century New Orleans, The Life and Times of Henry Louis Ray, Thursday, June 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elizabeth Williams, New Orleans native and founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, discusses New Orleans, a food biography. This year's One Book, One New Orleans selection at 7 p.m. Thursday, June 28th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.